This is The Guardian.
I'm Grace Dent, and this is Comfort Eating from The Guardian. A podcast where we pay homage to the lesser celebrated foods in life. Because even as a restaurant critic, I believe the food that matters most is often that snack you cobble together when you're curled up on the sofa. Each week, I ask my guest to lift the lid on what comfort foods have seen them through their lives. Because you can tell a lot about a person from what they eat behind closed doors. Hello, friends. You find me in my kitchen. It's a gorgeous day, sun blasting through the window. I am fresh from my weightlifting class. I am achy. I'm a little bit sweaty, if I'm honest. And boy, I am hungry. Even the endorphins I am maxing out on cannot quell the frenzy I am in, because there is a cult hero on his way over here as we speak. I've got time for a little snack. I'm having one of my favourite things ever. A little tin of cold Peppa Pig spaghetti shapes. Ah. It's one of my favourite things. The sauce clings to the Peppa Pigs far better than it does to Hoops. I will stand by this. The bell is about to go, and on my doorstep will be actor and screenwriter Jamie Demetrio. You will all remember his buck teeth as Bus Roden in Fleabag. He co-wrote and starred in Statlett's Flats, a hit which won him a batch of BAFTAs. He was in Paddington 2, and he's recently done the voice for a British bulldog in the new Will Ferrell film Strays. He was on our screens in a little film, kind of went under the radar, very small promo budget, Barbie. Might have passed you by. I'm itching to find out what Jamie is nibbling on when he is back home in his gym jams on the sofa after a long day's work.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Jamie Demetrio, welcome to Comfort Eating.
Thanks so much for having me at Comfort Eating.
You are an animal voiceover expert with proven improv skills. Now I'm going to show you something. Here is a photo of my new rescue cat, Shrimp, who this year has invaded first my garden and then my heart. I have a special request. Could you now channel this looseness into giving me the voice of Shrimp?
This is a left hook. Let's see the cat and then see what I got. Oh, it's good stuff. Okay, there's a character forming. Shrimp.
He keeps disappearing for 4 days and then coming back, eating two pouches of food and doing a shit in my strawberry patch. Like a lot of boyfriends.
Shrimp is non-committal.
absolutely non-committal.
Shrimp defecates in sort of seasonal patches.
Loves it. He loves it.
I'm going to give him a catchphrase. What?
Do it again.
Say something to Shrimp and I'll respond.
Where have you been?
What? It will work with anything, I guarantee. Give me another one.
Have you been getting food somewhere else?
What?
You know, it's actually very good.
It's not necessarily an accent. It's more an attitude. It's more a moment. It's more a 2023 moment.
What? Like, see, I can't do it. That's why I'm going to have to get you to do it.
What?
This is where I find out what my guest likes to eat behind closed doors. Jamie Demetriou, what have you got for me on this plate?
Okay, before I unveil it, I want to preface it with an acknowledgement of my own embarrassment. Mm-hmm. Because when people talk about guilty pleasures, I often find guilty pleasures to be a kind of difficult thing, because what do I actually feel embarrassed by and guilty about? Sure, I like to sort of occasionally squirt sriracha all over a crisp until you can't see the crisp anymore and stuff like that. But this is going to make me sound like the kind of person who sort of cooks a casserole for a house party, or maybe the kind of person who doesn't use deodorant.
I'm genuinely blushing.
Because
you're blushing.
I just know the way people react to this stuff and what it's going to say about me as a person.
Oh, darling,
I actually want to go.
There's no judgment here.
Right, I'm going to show it to you, and I want you to tell me what you think it is, and I'm going to correct you.
Jesus Christ, what's this going to be? Oh God! Right,
it looks like sick on harder sick.
If I had this growing on me, I would need antibiotics. It needs drained. So, what it is there's two rice cakes. Am I right?
They are lentil cakes. Continue.
Lentil cakes. Now, on top of it, is this the pus that you push out of acne?
I mean, it might as well be at this stage, because it is a lentil cake, which is an offshoot of the Callow rice cake brand. It's a bit crispier, and on top is a thin layer of butter, a thin layer of honey, smashed banana, and then a very, very light, and I'm going to lose everyone here, sprinkling of salt. She laughed.
Okay.
Grace is in hell.
The banana.
Okay, so basically, I grew up in a very rice cakey household, right? It was very late for everything because my mum wanted to butter two rice cakes before she left the house. And I drifted away from that. But as with so many things I was given as a child, I've sort of come back to them. And in later life, I've been looking for a snack that, because I inhale constantly stuff, and I've been looking for something healthy that I can have quite often. And basically, I made myself addicted to them to stop myself from being addicted to things that are bad for me. And it's worked.
So no more crack and heroin, 2CB, any of those things.
That's still very much on the menu. I'm talking about calorific stuff.
So now you're back on the lentil cakes.
Well, yeah, kind of. But I the thing about this is that's gutting to me is that I feel like what it needs to be is the fifth one you've had.
Okay.
As in, okay. It has to have bled into your system. And the thing that I like about the lentil cakes compared to the rice cakes is that they have more of a crisp. I'm not standing by it. I'm just trying to lay myself bare to the public.
The banana's gone black. I like that. Black banana mushed on lentil cakes.
Yeah, it's suicide.
I don't know if you need salt with banana, though. Where's the salt come from?
The salt is coming from my addiction to salt. And I think that a tiny sprinkle just offsets the sweetness of the honey and the banana. I mean, as if I'm talking about it as if it's a good thing. We've both just eaten a fart on a plate.
You were born in North London in 1987. You grew up with your mum, dad, and your older sister, Natasha. Now, you and Natasha both went on to be successful comedians. Where do you two get that funniness from?
I think we just festered in the same sort of hot stew of being stressed out kids and me trying to make it about food by referring to it as a hot stew. It's not good stuff. I don't know. We just kind of saw each other.
Yes.
I think we saw the value in having someone's eye to catch when you have a kind of shared sensibility. It's kind of like a blood sensibility that we're kind of born with, which I think most people have with their siblings. Mm. I just think we jumped on it in a big way and were like, that might be the most enjoyable part of life, those moments where we catch each other's eye about that. Let's do that every day, all the time, because it's probably the happiest we ever are. I mean, it was often us taking the mick out of each other as well and things that we'd done, and like those rare moments where you're able to not be defensive about something stupid you've done. Like, I remember we were in Brighton on holiday and there were two guys with bikes stood still having a chat about, like, must have been 50 meters ahead of us. And my sister was like, I bet you're going to trip over those bikes. And I was like, how the hell is that going to happen? It's 50 meters away. I can see them. And I fell over them so badly, I fell like to the floor and cut my leg.
And did she laugh?
Yeah. But it's something we like spoke about forever, because it's like, you know, I can see myself in that moment.
What's her thing that when she takes the piss out of you? It's like, my brother says that I've got wonky eyes and that my head is far, far bigger than my body. And these are the ones I can even say, right? And still now, he'll like, if I sent him a photo of me picking up an award, he will immediately send me a photo back holding a plate with his eyes crossed. Right?
The closest one I have is that everything I touch becomes crumpled.
What, is it because like you're so messy?
I have quite heavy hands, and I think I could have like a really nice sort of brown paper bag from a shop holding some beautiful goods, and within about 2 seconds it's like torn and looks like it's like a weird family heirloom for about 200 years. But I give as good as I get, but I won't go into that.
You grew up in the 90s. Give me a sense of family dynamic. So paint a picture of an average weekend, Shay Demetria.
I suppose it would involve a lot of being in a hot car while my dad maybe goes to visit his accountant. Sort of waiting for him to come out to take us swimming in Archway.
Just sitting in the back of the
car. Yeah, just sort of like...
giving each other dead arms, basically.
Yeah, with no kind of sense of when it might be over.
Your dad is Greek Cypriot. He's Indeed. A chef.
Yes.
So I'm imagining that when he's at home, the house is just this amazing, never-ending Greek smorgasbord of moussaka and lamb souvlaki. Baked halloumi.
Is that your imagination?
Yeah, that's what it's like. It's like you just come in and it's a little bit like, it's like Mamma Mia, the musical.
It was something to the left of that, maybe. I mean, look, because he was a full-time chef the whole time I was growing up. So as is the case, as I'm sure you know, with so many chefs, when you come home, it's more often than not just like unidentifiable pots of content.
Delicious.
Matter. Just some sort of evening matter.
What did he cook?
He would do an avio lemon soup is like a thing he would frequently cook, or he might do like, there would always be a piece of meat in the oven. It was like, I don't know what, I think he would sometimes get up at like 3 o'clock in the morning to cook meat to eat that evening.
Right.
Yeah. And the one thing that he did that really stays in my memory that me and my sister can never quite get our heads around is he'd roast potatoes. It was like the way that the gravy of the meat would infuse with the potatoes. Yes. It was like, you know, like waxy Cypriot potatoes?
Yeah.
It would be like, they'd be the butteriest, graviest, like softest things with no crisp on the outside, which is the traditional. I don't know how it works. It's magic.
But it's when you go to Greece Cyprus, and there's like a really, really, really old lady who just comes out. She's got the secret.
100%. And she and she's key. And it, but those places, even for me, and I, you know, I've got family there, I find it so difficult to find those places.
Yes. So when you're little, your dad ran a greasy spoon in Queen's Park. What was it like being in the cafe with just the regulars coming in? Do you end up kind of knowing them? Do you know their orders?
Oh, yeah. There was a guy whose order was toast without butter because he'd get a discount, and he'd use the salt, pepper and ketchup from the table as a topping so that he didn't have to pay for butter.
Toast with salt, pepper and ketchup.
Yeah. But I do think that experiences like that and various other ones were what led to my obsession with the British character.
Yes.
You know, seeing those people come in day in, day out, and their little foibles was unbelievable.
Were you ever let loose in the kitchen, in the cafe?
I would butter you a toast. No two ways about it. Maybe there was like a twang of like obsessiveness there, because I would watch my dad, because he was having to butter so much toast, because it was often only be him in there. Yeah. He would often sort of like put just one fat smear in the middle of it and not really think about it. And do you know what I mean? And I would be very corner to corner and getting a bit of a...
No dry bites. That's meant to be the point.
Oh, really?
Of toast. Did he do set meals?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was just everything you could imagine.
Did he do bubble?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But that was difficult because of the connotations of bubble, him being Greek. That is the...
Hang on. No, I don't
bubble and squeak is like Cockney rhyming slang slash...
Greek.
Yeah. It's not ideal. Well, it would often be like, you effing bubble would be the kind of... would be the thing. But he didn't really care. I think he's... You know, in kitchen culture, he would just kind of own that kind of thing, you know. And he grew up in kitchens with like... every ethnicity, you know, forever. And it was very much the culture to kind of josh with each other, you know.
Outside of your part-time job at the CAF, what's young Jamie like? You were in a band. And I absolutely love talking to people about their bands, because I think that it's so telling. My first question is, what was the band called?
We were called The Alphabeat, and then a band called Alphabeat came out with that song Fascination, and I think the general chat we had was, okay, we need to change our name, or we could just break up because it's not really good stuff.
Did you sing?
Yeah, I was the singer, yeah. Yeah, and I had that kind of, it was around a time that you weren't singing unless you had a London voice.
Is this a kind of... around the Libertines type.
Sure, yeah. Very kind of, whatever the kind of British equivalent of the Strokes, desperate to be the Strokes equivalent was.
So we're talking about 2001?
Wait,
2002?
How old would I have been? No, it was probably post all that. I think it was around more kind of late Baby Shambles-ish time.
Did you ever wear very tight trousers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, who hasn't?
Very tight trousers.
There was a place in Camden where they would stitch 501s to make them tighter, because no one was selling like drain pipes in shops, and I used to go down there every Friday to buy a pair to wear for the weekend. They cost like a fiver, and by the Sunday they would just be like big flaps of denim just hanging off my hips, and then I just go again next Friday and just ask them to re-sew them.
What was the Alphabeat's best song?
Best will be a strong word for any of them. Look, they were all right. My sister was a big fan. We had a song about a teacher I had who I really fancied called Cold Shoulder, and it was about me trying to tell her how mature I was.
Right, so I want you to do the chorus in the
burn. I will. Your house, I don't know what your insurance you have, but you don't want your house will smell of souvlaki.
Did you do it in this Cockney accent though?
Oh yeah, which is such a shame as well, because I adored singing in a kind of harmonious, like, I grew up singing.
Yes.
And I adored sort of like trying to sing nicely. And then there was a kind of, the cool thing to do would be to throw that in the bin and kind of purposefully, you know.
That is the Kooks.
Totally.
That is all of the Kooks songs. Do it again.
Right.
Do it again.
I don't know if I want to do it again.
Exactly that. Yeah. But did you want to be a rock star because you liked, you went, we were the Alpha B, thank you, and walked off and thought, oh, fucking hell, that was amazing. I was like,
oh, yeah,
a rock
yeah,
star.
Yeah. I would ping my braces and walk around the three people who'd watched like I was Dave Grohl. It was that being my reference these days as how far I've come from my band days. But yeah, no, I actually also think there's something to that. You know, it was like, it was an amazing time because it felt amazing at the time,
yes,
kind of thing. It, you know, I look back on it like incredibly fondly. Mm. And I do think that there was a kind of crossroads in my life where, you know, it probably wouldn't have been that specific thing, but I was like, either comedy or music. And then it was like, I really don't think I have the guts to be earnest for the rest of my life. And I was like, I do think that it takes it. It's quite like, maybe at the time I was quite cynical about it and was like what? Just like being really like sincere forever. Like, Jesus Christ, have a sense of humor. But now I'm like, I actually wish that I had it in me to, I like sort of try and find that part of myself more maybe.
You left school and ended up at Bristol University studying drama. That is a prestigious university. How tough was it to get on the course?
It should have been. I got in through, it turned out, like a clerical error. In my second year, I was de-rigging a stage with one of my tutors, and I think he was talking about how difficult it is for students to get in, and I was like, yeah, I mean, I can't believe I didn't get any A-levels. So he sort of laughed and I was like, what? Have you just seen something out the window or something? And he was like, no, what do you mean you didn't do it? You must have done it. You need to get whatever and above to come here. And I was like, no. And he like ran to the office to check my file and was like, never tell anyone this. So I don't know how I managed it. But, I do not know, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
You must have felt different to everyone that was there, surely.
Thick, yeah. Definitely. I would go into lectures or seminars and everyone would whip out their notebooks to sort of take notes on what the lecturer was saying. And I was like, oh, well, it's novel. I was like, oh, right, I should do that in the next one. And then I would just write down what they said, not knowing why I was doing it. Because yes. And just like be like, okay, so that's my, it's quite hard to listen to what they're saying while I'm writing it down, but sure. And then I would never address what it said in the book because I didn't have a kind of like formal post-school education.
Now at uni, usually you live in halls or shared housing and the kitchen is generally so disgusting it should be cordoned off. Everyone has a staple dish that they churn out again and again, though. What was your uni staple dish?
It was pasta, usually fusilli, yeah, with a Sackler coriander pesto, chopped up sweet chili co-op sausages, and sweet chili sauce, Blue Dragon sweet chili sauce on top with lots of grated cheddar. It was like a coma inducer.
I mean, look, I think that's one of the worst things anyone's ever told me on this podcast. It just kept coming. At no point during that sentence did I know what the next word was going to be. Did you have a vegetable in there as well?
Yes, a Sackler coriander pesto.
So you ate this a lot. So, I mean, obviously this is one of the things that you could probably leave in the stove and no one's going to steal it.
I mean, no, you're so wrong. I mean, the students in my house would eat way worse than that. I mean, the majority of the fridge was taken up by those like 10p sort of sausages of economy pate from Tesco with the four blue stripes on them. I mean, I'll say this, just for the listeners hearing about this lentil cake and the pasta, I back my palate. I'm not ashamed of what passes my teeth. I think that you're hearing the worst. There's some great stuff out there in my fridge, etc.
Again, nobody has ever stopped halfway through just to make the point that they back their palate.
Like, look, I'm breaking boundaries on the podcast.
Back my palate. It's like,
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Hello, Grace Dent here. One more thing. If you love comfort eating, then you'll love my new book, Comfort Eating, What We Eat When No One's Looking. It's available order now. There's an ebook and an audiobook if you want me to read it to you, with chapter headings like Why Butter Makes Everything Better and Why Potatoes Are Proof of a Higher Power, How Can You Resist? Comfort Eating is packed with funny, moving stories about my family and my childhood, as well as recipes and stories about recording the show.
You start performing with a comedy group at uni, going to the Edinburgh Fringe year after year. And then after a few years, you book your own venue for a one-man stand-up show. Okay, how does that go?
I did a few gigs around London in preparation, which is what you're supposed to do, yeah. Really. But I would do 10 minutes at a time. And I basically realised by the time I got there that I only had 10 minutes for the hour slot that I booked on the Free Fringe. And I just had a creative block and just couldn't generate more. Luckily, it was a free show and but it was on at like 2 p.m. So
you got to Edinburgh with no show.
I got to Edinburgh with about 10, 15 minutes of material and I could vamp for like an extra kind of...
Vamp.
Like ask people improvise. In the audience. Just vamp. Sort of like just... Like dragging out, I guess, like positive dragging out. But I would vamp for like an like improvise for like 10 minutes in the end, and then just be like, "Sorry, everyone, that's actually all I've got." And then I'd found out that a couple of people were going to be at the show on the Friday.
TV execs,
yeah. So, and I find this out on the Tuesday, and I basically just didn't sleep for 3 nights. And I would just talk to myself all night in different character voices, seeing what I could generate. There was a kind of wig shop on the way to the venue, and every day I'd pick up a different wig and trial one of the voices. And I was like, that can sort of work with the kind of scary kind of nanny voice I was doing, so I'll do that. And then by the time the Friday came round, I had an hour that was like wonky, but... I do think that sometimes the kind of, you know, the adrenaline of it kind of sees you through, and it ended up being an all right show, and it ended up being the kind of foundation for what I did for the rest of the month.
If I was a fly on the wall during those 2 days, what would I see?
Nudity.
No clothes. Yeah. Just running around with the wigs.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Very kind of distressing. Basically, it would have made good footage for a kind of Aphex Twin music video.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This catapulted you off into a stand-up comedy career. Fast forward to 2016. Mm. You land the role in the TV adaptation of Phoebe Waller-Bridge's Fleabag as Bus Rodent. Mm-hmm. This is a guy with buck teeth who Fleabag meets on the bus and whom she hates but gets into a relationship with because she hates herself. And the show very quickly becomes this massive juggernaut, this massive stratospheric success, watched by millions, wins Emmys, Golden Globes, BAFTAs, everything, the lot, the world on a plate, and you're in it. I reckon that for a lot of people, this is their first encounter with you. How do things change?
Well, I suppose what changed in a big way for me was, from my personal experience, was kind of witnessing Phoebe's process on mm-hmm. set and, you know, just being like, this can be done so well, you know, making telly can be, not that I hadn't seen it before, you know, I'd done a lot of kind of bit parts and stuff and I'd been in some really good stuff, but it was really, you know, it was a kind of transcendent experience shooting it. I mean, the thing about it is it's been such a huge deal and I shot maybe 4 days on it. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, it was like a huge thing that went on for ages for me. I just sort of went, witnessed how amazing what she was doing was, and then it kind of exploded and people would sort of look in my mouth forevermore to find out if my teeth are real or not.
But you must have gone from being fairly incognito in restaurants to having that experience where you're sitting there and you know that those two are going,
oh, they're not doing it secretly.
And then they go like that. And then they get a photo up of you and you can see it. And it's always you looking really ropey and they go. So do you get that?
I think.
Do you see people mime the teeth?
Oh, at the time there was a fair bit of that. When it was like on, especially when like specifically when series two came about, actually, that was quite a lot. But you know, all you ask for is that when that stuff happens, it's for something that you're proud of. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can't really even take any pride in the show. It's just, it's so her creation and her thing and everything. And I just was so lucky to have slid into it. And I do think that, you know, work breeds work. And if you're lucky enough to have worked on something people like, I just think you're lucky enough to be given opportunities. And I think that Stath was probably a long-term, not immediate, but a kind of gradual fallout.
Things start getting even more exciting. Stath Let's Flats premieres on Channel 4. You created, wrote and starred in a show as a ridiculous, incompetent estate agent, desperate to take over his family's letting agency. It has since won 3 BAFTAs. Right. Have you ever had to deal with estate agents since then?
Oh, yeah. And they're big believers in staff being a kind of impression of someone else in their office, but it's always them. The weirdest thing about it is you would imagine that touring me around, they'd mind their P's and Q's and be on their best behavior, trying not to say anything stupid. But you're getting every, it's like, this table would make a brilliant shelf, obviously, as there's no storage. Obviously, this window you can't see through, but it's the kind of window that has the potential to be something that if you were to think hard, you could imagine what was outside it, if that makes sense. You know, just it's never, and you're like, you know that, you've just told me you watched the show, you know that I'm going to take that. Anyway, I would go on a lot of tours just without needing a flat kind of thing.
This year you played a toy company executive in what casually became the biggest box office hit of the entire year, Greta Gerwig's Barbie. Now, not to state the absolute bleeding obvious, but summer 23 was Barbie hysteria. You've been in feature films before, but Barbie was clearly filmmaking on a ridiculous scale. I read somewhere that the production caused a worldwide shortage of pink paint.
I mean, possibly, who knows? I'm going to judge the world for not having enough pink paint. I mean, that says more about the world and the amount of pink paint it has and the amount of Barbie used.
For people who weren't there, talk me through the sheer scale of being involved in the Barbie production juggernaut.
Well, you know, my role was very, very small. I was very much a kind of, you know, a cog in an unbelievable process, actually. Not dissimilar to Fleabag in the sense that it just felt like something being done right. Mm. Just was done with so much love. Greta, just the most extraordinary director I've seen work. You know, it felt like an egoless production where everyone felt really a part of it and they were trying to make something amazing. I think they were genuinely just trying to make something really, really good as opposed to just filling a brief.
Was the on-set catering on Barbie pink?
Was the food pink?
Absolutely. Was it blancmange?
No. I would love to say that it was, but no. It was your standard high-quality American film production fare, the likes of, you know, the optional afternoon wrap if you'd like it.
Yeah.
There'd be smoothies and stuff like that around, which I'm sure you could make pink if you wanted.
Did you go rollerblading with Will Ferrell?
Yeah. Absolutely, right. For the film.
Is that nerve-wracking?
In what sense?
So you go, holy shit, I've got to go out there and it's Will Ferrell and I've got to be funny and amazing and remember my lines.
I think the rollerblading part was the more scary because, you know, we, like me and Andrew Leung and Connor Swindells kind of played Will's assistants. So we were a kind of quartet for those 8 weeks and there's a lot of kind of waiting around together. So I was lucky enough to, you know, Will's like the just the easiest, nicest, just like not a scary presence whatsoever.
What did you actually do when you're just waiting around with Will Ferrell?
Sort of ate McCoys because there were a lot of McCoys available to us. And just
did you have
sort
a little bit of a dip on the go or just McCoys?
I would
we're talking
a McCoy
about crisps.
Does not lend it. Yes, of course. A McCoy doesn't lend itself to instinctively. It's not. I don't think. I actually would think that that's like the last crisp I'd think of dipping. Are you different to that?
I don't think any crisp is too big for a dip. I think we can bring it.
Apart from like a novelty sized crisp.
Is it true that you had never actually eaten eggs?
Yeah.
Until you were almost this age now.
I think I was 23. So I just thought they were sort of oval farts for the longest time. I didn't understand how someone could smell a fart and shout that it smelled like egg and then eat the thing that smelled like a fart. I'm not even going to partake. And then,
so you thought that because people said that farts were eggy, that meant that eggs were actual farts?
Yes. And I was looking, when I would occasionally taste an egg, I was looking to corroborate with my theory.
And then what's the breakthrough? What's your breakthrough egg?
The breakthrough egg was, I think it was a fried lad. And it was a fried lad.
I love that.
It did the job. And it continues to do the job. And I will argue that I, as a result, enjoy eggs more than anyone who ate them as a kid because I'm still in the kind of honeymoon phase with them. It's still a surprise to me that I have this amazing food stuff that you can't, you know, right. In fact, Grace Dent.
Hello.
Tell me what an egg tastes like.
It's got a definite dairy creaminess to it, but only in bits of it. Is it bitter? It tastes like an egg.
It's impossible. It's incomparable. I don't know why I want it. I don't know why I love it so much. I don't know why I love every form of it. I don't know why I love what it does to everything you mix it with. Mm-hmm. But it's just like warm flavor.
It's flavor of warmth and richness.
Yeah.
It's richness.
It is, but it's like liquid richness.
Yeah.
There's no kind of discernible flavour to it whatsoever, but you crave it and it's really nice.
But it's the only thing that you have to suspend your knowledge of what it is. I think that you're eating it whilst never really thinking what this is, because I think it's just almost too much. It's just it's absolutely on the borderline of ick.
Sure. And especially because, like, with a steak or something, you're very much confronted with what it is and you can't really avoid it. I don't think that you can tell yourself
it's
anything.
You have to eat it with something. It has to sit on a carbohydrate.
Yeah, totally. Although that said, in going to Paris and having like earth with like mayonnaise and like a bit of salt and pepper and maybe like a little kind of just all the kind of bits.
Yes.
Is like one of my dream foodstuffs.
We're coming to the end of our time together.
And I never said a nice thing. I tried to kind of, I tried to make people think I have a good palate by saying I like to go to Paris and dip a boiled egg in mayonnaise.
We're going
to
cut all that out. All that is going to be is you foisting black banana that made with salt on it. Mate. We're going to have a little bit of a choose your own adventure scenario.
Okay.
It's the present day. Jamie Demetrio, once heir to his own cafe empire, walks into a greasy spoon, but now having finally awoken to the deliciousness of egg. He's having egg for breakfast. And now he's faced with a crucial, gut-wrenching, yet age-old choice. Scrambled or sunny side up.
What's the establishment? My dad's
it's
cafe.
It's family cafe.
It's my dad's cafe. It's got to be fried because you can't really fail. And a scrambled in a kind of greasy spoon kind of vibe is never right for me. A scrambled there. That kind of like rubbery, like white. I like a greasy spoon fried egg because it's the only place where they manage to sort of... I traditionally would cook a crispy, like sunny side up fried egg, but they managed to...
Completely white, almost like...
Same consistency on top as it is underneath somehow.
Almost poached, but oiled. An oiled poached egg.
It's almost the consistency of oil, isn't it?
Yes, with a runny yolk.
Yeah.
From egg odyssey to your career odyssey, it's been quite the journey.
The gesticulation I'm witnessing is electric.
Where do you go from here? Are you focusing solely on Barbie spin-off movies for the foreseeable?
Not solely, no. Just more egg stuff, really. Just really kind of get to grips with egg. Seeing if there's one I haven't tried. Can you tell me an egg that I might not have tried?
Have you had little quail's eggs?
No. So that's my answer. Little. So it went Barbie, little quail's eggs.
Jamie Demetrio.
Hiya.
Thank you. It has been an absolute journey. Thank you so much for comfort eating with me.
Thanks for having me here.
And
I'm so sorry. Really, everyone, just know that I do like nice stuff. Cheers.
This episode of Comfort Eating was produced by Gabriella Jones. The executive producer is Lucy Greenwell. The music was written by Axel Cacoutier. Mixing and sound design was by Solomon King. If you like Comfort Eating, then please go and leave us a review. And you can follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode. See you next week.
This is The Guardian.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.